cow folk went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up a cloud he draw.
This is Dan McClure, volunteer reader for Some Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will conclude reading from Hearts West, True Stories of Mail-Order Brides on the Frontier. This was written by Chris Enns, E-N-S-S, and published in 2005 by Two Dot Publishing in Guilford, Connecticut, and Helena, Montana. And before we begin, let me remind you that our stories are sometimes edited slightly for recording. Now we shall read Trouble on a Bridal Tour. In 1886, passengers aboard the Union Pacific Railroad, traveling from Riverside across California, were aghast at an overt display of affection between a groom and his mail-order bride. The blissful couple, excited about their marriage, fawned over each other so much that their fellow riders complained. The following is an article about the so-called appalling event. Now, what's the use of it? When a couple get married and go off on a bridal tour, why so misbehave themselves as to be spotted by every man, woman, and child on the train for fresh fish? How silly the thing must appear to them when they look back after a period of 6 months. Are we fools when in love? And are we idiots when we marry? The couple I have in mind had a seat in the middle of the car. She was his'n, and he was her'n. All the tomfoolery of courtship days was over. The preacher had made things right, and her father would no longer set the dog on him or place torpedoes around the gate. She didn't show the least disposition to jump out of the car window, but all of a sudden, he grabbed her by the paw. She grabbed back. Then he leaned over at an angle of 45 degrees, and she fell toward him. It was a very uncomfortable position, but they maintained it with scarcely any change for hours. Her hat got skewed around almost hindside before, but she could not release her clutch for fear he'd go through the roof. His collar wilted, and his necktie worked around under his ear, but if he let go of her paw, she'd think he was mad. "Darling," said he in a bullfrog whisper, "doesn't it seem funny?" "I can't realize it," as she raked one of her back hairpins across his nose. "Oh, mine?"
"Yes, lovely."
"Never get mad?"
"Never, sweetie."
The man on the seat behind them folded up the paper, picked up his grip, and changed to a seat across the aisle. As he sat down, a motherly-looking woman inquired, "Are they married?"
"I think so, madam. A mail-order match, I overheard."
"And can nothing be done to stop it?"
"I think not."
For 2 or 3 minutes, the newly wedded were silent. "Darling," she sighed.
"What is it? If any base hyena has dared to cause you a moment's unhappiness, I'll murder him. Point out the animal."
"It isn't that."
"Then what?"
I'm afraid you'll be mad."
"No, I won't. How could I be mad at you? What is it, Dolly?"
"Why, I wish you'd wipe the sweat out of that left ear. Now, you love me just the same, don't you?"
"Of course."
"And you aren't mad?"
"Why, no." "There now, who cares who's looking? It's nobody's business, anyhow."
There was another interval of silence during which she tried to remember whether they were engaged the week before her father gave Henry the book, or whether it was the next Sunday after. "Henry."
"What, angel?"
"Are we really married?"
"Yes, love."
"And you love me?"
"With all my heart."
"And you aren't mad?"
"No, dearest."
"Then I'm so happy. Henry, squeeze my hand."
"He suppose."
"We held an indignation meeting and appointed a committee to see if something could not be done, but he just squoze the harder. 3 or 4 women got together and passed a resolution to the effect that if a railroad company could not protect its passengers,
The legislature should be appealed to. But that couple had a death grip on each other and wouldn't let go. The baggage man came in when sent for, but said that he was helpless. He knew just how we must feel, but the railroad wasn't to blame. The conductor came back to the car and asked us not to lay it up against him. He was a poor man, had been out of a job several months, and this was his first run. Well, the long and the short of the matter was that 18 or 20 of us rode 150 miles, wishing we had not gotten on the train, and resolving that the thing will never happen again. Never. We shook hands on that and agreed that we'd walk first. And that was from the Daily Press of Riverside, California, July 10, 1886. Now we will read Bridal Couples. During the late 1880s, gold country hostelries were literally filled with blushing brides. Women arrived from eastern locations to wed the men they'd met through mail-order advertisements and to set up house in the rich hills of Northern California. San Francisco was one of the most popular places in the country to honeymoon. Couples found it to be a cheerful city with enough sights to occupy their time for months. The presence of many new partners gave the location a sense of solace that helped make the mail-order pairs feel at home as well. San Francisco innkeepers competed for the business of honeymooning couples, offering them a variety of goods and services in return for staying at their establishments. The rivalry between the hotels was fierce and often made front-page news. What we will now read is from the Matrimonial News of January 1887. So great has become the competition between three or four of the leading city's hotels in the solicitation for bridal couples that the most successful of the landlords in this effort presents each one of the brides who stop at his hostelry a beautiful bouquet or basket of cut flowers. The clerk who receives the couple inquires of the bridegroom if he suspects a recent marriage, and it is seldom that a mistake is made. And then the flowers go up to the apartments engaged. One of the most lucrative classes for the landlords is the newly married. Beginning in October and ending in April, it is estimated that there are in the city an average, all the time, of 200 pairs of brides and grooms. The manager of the hotel, which entertains most of them, says he frequently has 40 couples and averages over 25 during the busy season. They are, he says, the most desirable of guests. Always pleasant, they want the best of everything, and are given it. This hostelry makes a feature of pleasing those people, and all embarrassments are lessened to the minimum. Guests there are so used to seeing large number of brides and grooms that they are spared the stares so customary where this class is rare. It is said to be the purpose of the great hotel company organizing here, and which intends to build a structure at a cost of $2,500,000 to arrange one floor with bridal apartments. Now we will read Kathleen Forrestal, Irish Bride in Waiting. A weather-beaten stage labored over a rocky incline, then came to a stop to give the tired team of horses a chance to rest. Three road-weary passengers emerged from the coach and looked around. 18-year-old Kathleen Forrestal was among them. She was a tall woman with red hair, green eyes, and a shocking number of freckles scattered across her face. She stared down at the valley below and at Fort Klamath in the near distance. She'd left her home in County Cork, Ireland, on March 10, 1853. 5 months later, she was now looking out over the Oregon Territory that was to be her new home. Kathleen's journey to the West had been a difficult one. Since reaching the States, she'd encountered rugged terrain, torrential downpours, and hostile Indians, and been robbed of her life savings. Nevertheless, considering the tragic life she had left behind in her homeland, these struggles were much more bearable. Kathleen was born on November 16, 1835, in Waterford, Ireland. Her parents were farmers who had seven children to help them work a 32-acre plot of land that belonged to a British couple. She was the oldest girl and dreamed of becoming a school teacher. Kathleen was an exceptional student
and her mother and father encouraged her in all of her scholastic endeavors. When she was 14, however, a countrywide famine forced her to reevaluate her life's pursuit. By the time Kathleen became a teenager, the population in Ireland was more than 8 million. There were few industries, so the country depended largely on agriculture. Farms decreased in size as the population grew. Most of the people, such as the Forrestals, lived as tenants on the small farms they worked, and most of the produce they raised had to be turned over to the landlord as rent. Kathleen's family, and others like them, had to struggle to survive on what was left from their production. In 1848, a blight or disease infected the crops, rotting potatoes. Millions faced starvation. During the time of the first failed crops, Kathleen lost her mother and five of her siblings to hunger and to sickness. Many of Kathleen's neighbors and friends were emigrating out of the country and making their way to America or Canada. Kathleen, having watched her family starve, determined she would leave Ireland as soon as she could raise the money to do so. An opportunity arose when a doctor who was paying a visit to the Forrestal home shared a copy of a San Francisco paper with Kathleen. The publication contained ads from pioneers and Western settlers searching for wives, and many articles told of the shortage of women in the remote areas of the West and the opportunities available for adventurous females making a new life. Kathleen pored over the advertisements, looking for a suitable solicitor. Within the numerous announcements was a plea from a young soldier. "In the interests of lifelong companionship and devotion, I am submitting this notice. I am a soldier with the United States Army. I am 27 years of age and of good, sturdy stock. I would like to correspond with a lady interested in matrimony." And that was written by Lieutenant Fred M. Carey in 1851. Kathleen sent a letter off to Lieutenant Carey describing her background, religious views, physical appearance, and desire to marry. The written courtship was short, and the lieutenant proposed to Kathleen in his second letter. He also sent along the funds necessary for her to make her way to America. After bidding farewell to her father and sisters, she boarded a ship and set sail in search of a better life. The voyage across the Atlantic was challenging. Kathleen was hundreds of miles from Ireland, but still feeling the pangs of hunger because the vessel was poorly equipped with provisions. She survived on stale crackers and tea until the ship docked at the Isthmus of Panama, where she was able to purchase bananas and bread. She befriended another woman on the journey, and the two spent a great deal of time together, swapping secrets and plans for the future. Kathleen foolishly told her new confidant the hiding place for the money sent to her by her lieutenant. Before the ship made port again, the woman had stolen $300 that Kathleen had sewn into the lining of one of her dresses. When Kathleen arrived in San Francisco, she was virtually penniless. She sent a wire to the groom-to-be, and Lieutenant Carey arranged to pay for her stage fare. After a long, grueling ride, the coach arrived at Fort Klamath. Kathleen's lieutenant was there to meet her. Fred Carey was a shy, unassuming, slightly balding man who stood barely over 5 feet 5 inches tall. The two smiled at one another and politely shook hands. He escorted her to the fort's guest quarters, and after giving her a chance to unpack, the two set out for a walk. Kathleen and Fred spent 2 days getting to know each other. He explained the vagabond lifestyle of a soldier, and she agreed to take on all the responsibilities that were expected of an army wife. A wedding date was set for the next time a minister would be at the fort. A pair of officers' wives offered to help Kathleen make preparations for the big day. A week before Fred and Kathleen exchanged vows, the lieutenant was ordered to escort a supply wagon to Fort Walla Walla in the northern portion of the state. The couple said their goodbyes, and the lieutenant promised to hurry back. As he left, Kathleen realized, for the first time, how much she had become attached to him. She had not anticipated falling in love, but, happily, she had. During Fred's absence, a social was held in honor of the fort's commanding officer's birthday. An array of food was served, parlor games were played, and there was music and dancing. Kathleen joined in the festivities, contributing a pie to the banquet and agreeing to dance with some of the soldiers. She had a delightful time and made sure those around her were equally as joyful. Upon Fred's return, the men in his service complimented him on his choice for a wife. They bragged about her cooking and her talent as a dancer. Fred was simply horrified to learn that his intended had engaged in such inappropriate behavior while he was away. He confronted Kathleen, who, seeing no harm in what she had done, confessed to the actions. The outraged and humiliated lieutenant called off the wedding. Kathleen begged him to reconsider, but he refused. Adding insult to injury, he demanded the money he invested in his mail-order bride be returned. In order to earn the funds needed to repay Fred, Kathleen took on the job as the fort's laundry woman. Once financial restitution had been made, she relocated to San Francisco. Historical records show that she answered another advertisement for a mail-order bride, and this time successfully married the ad's author. The newlyweds moved to a mining camp in Placer County and opened a boarding house. Lieutenant Fred M. Carey never married. Now we shall read The New Plan, a magazine for matrimony. Tears slid down widow Mabel Haskell's face and fell onto the blank piece of paper in front of her. She sat poised, pen in hand, over the monogram stationery, contemplating her life and lamenting her cheerless state of affairs. The sad but striking-looking woman in her late 40s had no family, no children of her own, and had lost her husband of 23 years 10 months earlier. She was lonely and fearful that she would always remain so. Desperate for companionship, Mabel decided to advertise for a partner. She knew other women whose solicitation for a spouse had been answered, and a handful of those were fortunate enough to marry the men who replied. Mabel wondered if she would be as lucky. Blinking away tears, she decided the time was right to submit an ad to the popular publication, The New Plan. Perhaps an equally lonely gentleman would read the personal plea and seek her out. Perhaps she would find love again. Helping eligible men and women find one another, correspond, and marry was the main goal of The New Plan. Published in Kansas City, Missouri, the magazine's purpose was to unite lonely hearts with various monetary and social backgrounds who were unable to find a desirable life partner. And here's how the intro read. Ladies especially, whose opportunities are somewhat limited as to forming acquaintances, seek the method proposed in The New Plan, knowing that in no other way they have so much advantage. Don't think because you are not wealthy yourself that you cannot get a rich party to marry you. Love is not measured in lucre. Morality, fidelity, respectability, ambition, and beauty often tip the opposing weight of wealth on the matrimonial scale. Women in affluent circumstances are not usually seeking an increase of wealth in marriage. The self-respecting man of means, in seeking a wife, is not seeking her for the property she may have. We get many inquiries from both sexes who have plenty of means for two and who seek life companions of true worth and not for means. We do business with such people constantly and know whereof we speak. The New Plan Notice, 1917. A list of the magazine's aims and methods of business were listed on the back cover of each edition. The ample and easy-to-follow plan promised speedy and satisfactory results for all who submitted an advertisement. Our time and money is devoted entirely to the interest of the unmarried. To elevate and promote the welfare of marriageable people and furnish a safe, reliable, and confidential method at a nominal cost, whereby good, honorable people of sincere and moral intentions may better enable themselves to become acquainted with a large number of such people of the opposite sex as they may deem worthy of consideration, which may lead to their future happiness and prosperity. The New Plan, 1917. The personal ads in the publication were genuine, and ladies whose advertisements were published signed a statement in which they agreed to answer every letter received from interested gentlemen readers who enclosed postage, either accepting or declining correspondence. The cost for each advertisement was $1. The magazine's editors boasted that this offer was the greatest bargain in the world for the money. The New Plan was in circulation from 1911 to 1917. The following are samples of advertisements found in the September 1917 edition of the periodical. The first advertisement was submitted by Mabel Haskell. I am a lonely, unencumbered widow, age 48, weight 165, height 5 feet 6 inches, big blue eyes, brown hair, fair complexion, American, religion, Methodist. I have property worth $30,000. A sunny disposition, considered very good looking. Would like to hear from some good businessman. Object, matrimony. Here's the next announcement. A very stylish and attractive widow by death. I wonder what other kind of widow there might be. With property worth $3,000. Age, 33. Weight, 125. Height, 5 feet 5 inches. Blue eyes, brown hair. Complexion, fair. American, good housekeeper and cook. Would marry if I can find a congenial companion. Either city or country life. Will answer all letters containing stamps. Will inherit $6,000. Then there's this one. I am a good-looking young lady, a brunette, with velvet brown eyes, brown hair, and fair complexion. Height, 5 feet 6 inches. Weight, 141 pounds. Age, 20. I have a college education and am highly accomplished in music and in voice. Have a kind and cheerful disposition and am a lover of home and children. Have means of $20,000 and an income of $100 per month. I desire the acquaintance of good moral men of any age. And that was followed by, I do not pose as a beauty, but people tell me that I look well. I enjoy fun and social gatherings. Age, 27. Weight, 138. Height, 64 inches. Brown eyes. Brown hair. Fair complexion. American. Very good disposition. Plain dresser, but neat. Prefer country life. Income, $20 per month. Matrimonially inclined. Then there's this one. Everybody says that I'm fine looking for my age. Am honest, intelligent, neat, clean, kind-hearted, and have a good character. Age, 58. Weight, 120. Height, 5 feet 5 inches. Blue eyes, brown hair, fine homemaker. Income, $200 per year. Have real estate worth $4,000. Object, matrimony. Will answer all letters. And now there's this advertisement. A winsome miss of 22. Very beautiful, jolly, and entertaining. Fond of home and children, from a good family. American, Christian, blue eyes, golden hair, fair complexion, pleasant disposition, play piano. Will inherit $10,000. Also have means of $1,000. None but men of good education from 20 to 38 years of age need to write. Here's one that's rather poignant. Would like to get married because I'm lonesome. Am considered rather good-looking and of a lovable disposition. Age, 35. Height, 5 feet 5 inches. Weight, 145. Hazel eyes, brown hair, American. Occupation, stenographer and bookkeeper. Will inherit a few thousand. Will answer all letters. Then there's this. Society has no charms for me. I prefer a quiet life. Am an American lady with common school education, well thought of and respected. Age 25, height 5 feet 9 inches, weight 155, blue eyes, light hair. Have means of $3,000. Wish correspondence with good-natured, honest, industrious man. That's followed by a perfect blonde, trained nurse, wishes to make the acquaintance of nice young gentleman with a view to matrimony. Age 23, weight 124, height 5 feet 3 inches, German-American, college education, very neat dresser, will answer all letters. And our next young lady issues a challenge. Who will be the first to write to this lady of 33 years? Weight 100, height 5 feet 2 inches, brown eyes, brown hair, light complexion, occupation dressmaker, fine housemaker and cook, kind, good-natured disposition, would marry if suited, country life preferred. And here's one for senior citizens. Dear old men, here is your chance to get a true loving companion. I am a widow by death, age 69 years, but don't look or feel or act over 40. Always in good humor, very loving and kind. A good housekeeper, weight 104, height 5 feet 2 inches. Blue eyes, brown hair, nationality German. Would like to meet some congenial gentleman near my own age, with means enough to make me a good home. Now here's someone who's being upfront. Hello, all you widowers and bachelors. Write this way if you are looking for a companion. Here she is, age 60, weight 100, height 4 feet 11 inches, black eyes, dark hair, American, golden rule religion, jolly and good-natured, have means of $3,000, wish a husband with some means, city or country, age from 50 to 75, will answer all letters. The last line of this one made me chuckle. Boys, I am a handsome little girl, alone in the world, and earning my own living, and I am tired of doing so. My age is 20 years, weight 145, height 5 feet 3 inches, blue eyes, dark hair, good housekeeper, am considered good looking, have some means, also piano, common school education, prefer country life, will marry if suited, no Catholics need to write. And now we have, am well known and respected by all. American, golden rule religion, age 19, weight 132, height 5 feet 3 inches, dark brown eyes, brown hair, olive complexion, live with my parents, high school education, very musical and trained voice, have means of $6,000, also will inherit, want to become acquainted with moral men of suitable age. And here's a challenge for you. Who wants to correspond with a jolly little blonde, a lover of peace and harmony, always tries to make others happy, age 22, weight 115, height 5 feet 2 inches, light hair, blue eyes, fair complexion, wish to hear from true, honest gentlemen of good character. All worthy letters will be answered. Now there's this one. Would like to hear from a man of good business ability and of neat personal appearance. I am 33 years of age, weight 117, height 5 feet 4 inches, blue eyes with brown hair, American, common school education, good personal appearance, fond of home and children, do not care for society, have property worth $1,000. Then, here is a pretty blonde with pretty blue eyes, very fair complexion, good education, modest by occupation, age 28, weight 160, height 5 feet 9 inches, very neat and fond of home. Wish to hear from businessman or farmer with his own farm. Lover of home and children. Will answer all letters. Will inherit. And here's an eager notice. Gentlemen, I am in earnest. Would like to hear from men of good character and reputation who need and would appreciate a good, trustworthy woman. Am 45 years old. Weight 130. Height 5 feet 5 inches. Blue eyes. Black hair. Nationality Mexican. Have property worth $500. Will inherit $2,000. Will correspond for matrimony. And here's a rather brief one. Here comes a sweet lady from the land of flowers and sunshine. Age 35. Weight 150. Height 5 feet 8 inches. Brown eyes. Brown hair. Rosy complexion. A musician. Occupation and real estate. Have income, also some means. Object, matrimony. Now we hear from someone who says, I am in every way qualified to appreciate and care for a good partner and home. Am healthy, of neat appearance, affectionate and genial disposition. Age 20, weight 123, height 5 feet 5 inches. Dark brown eyes and hair, thoroughly competent in housework and farming. Will inherit, answer all letters. Then we hear from American girl, farmer's daughter, raised on the farm. Own 40 acres, father owns 100. Would consider marriage if I can find some good, honest man. No objections to widower with one or two children. My age is 22, weight 160, height 5 feet 6 inches, black hair and eyes. Write and learn more. Then there is this one. Am a home-loving lady, never was married, am lonely, and wish to hear from a good man who loves home life. I am German-American, age 30, weight 140, height 5 feet 4 inches, blue eyes, light hair, fair complexion, have some real estate, prefer city life, matrimonially inclined. And here's one that's forthright. A widow of refinement and education would be pleased to hear from gentlemen, one who is not looking for money, but for a companion. I'm a well-read woman, traveled 10 years for a firm, and have been all over USA. Age 50, weight 160, height 5 feet 2 inches, dark blue eyes, dark hair mixed with gray, nationality English, Scotch, will answer all letters containing stamps. And here's an enthusiastic one. Boys, you'll enjoy receiving my letters, for I'm a jolly girl. Age 24, weight 130. Height, 5 feet 5 inches, brown eyes, blonde hair, nationality, French, Catholic religion, occupation, stenographer, income, $1,000, play violin, will write for fun or matrimony, Catholics preferred. If any of the advertisements resulted in matrimony, the subscriber and author of the ad agreed to pay a $5 service fee to the magazine, and this is the way the new plan describes it in 1917. We aid our members in every way possible to find their ideal, and expect they will be prompt in paying us when they find the person of their choice, as we receive nothing for our time and labor until marriage occurs. We realize that we have something to do and will work faithfully. Again, that's from the new plan in 1917. Now we shall read the afterword. Throughout the mid-1800s, adventurous men from Boston to Georgia rushed west to lay claim to parts of the wild frontier. They came to farm, trap, ranch, and establish businesses. Those who heard the California streams were lined with gold came to find their fortune. While some found riches, many struggled winter after winter, unable to find a single nugget. Prosperous or poor, all at one time or another were lonesome, longing for the stability that only the company of a woman could provide. As there were very few available women living in the West, the only option was to attract women from the East. In an effort to entice the female population to the unsettled land, unique methods were employed. Men sought prospective brides through churches back home, letters to available school teachers, and advertisements in newspapers and magazines. The practice of seeking a bride in this manner continued on into the turn of the century. Women in the East and the Midwest responded to ads, exchanged letters and photos, and eventually agreed to marry men they had never met. Ranchers like John Bartley of North Dakota had doubts that he would ever find a wife through an advertisement. After his friends assured him that there was a chance it could happen, he reluctantly placed an ad in a Pennsylvania newspaper. The article on page 4 of the May 8, 1912 edition of a North Dakota newspaper proved that Bartley's friends were right and restored his faith in the want heads. Reverend C. L. Wallace of the Methodist Church solemnized a marriage last evening, which is the happy culmination of a novel but ardent courtship. About a year and a half ago, John Bartley, a prosperous farmer of Newbury Township and the stepson of P. W. Heinbaugh, advertised in some rural paper for a wife with which to share his prosperity and comfortable home. He stated the fact that he was the owner of a well-stocked farm of 640 acres of Ramsey County land. The advertisement found its way to McIntosh, Minnesota, where Mrs. C. E. Davis, who is devoted to her granddaughter, Marjorie, and is desirous that the young girl would enjoy some of the luxuries of life which she could not afford to give her, answered the advertisement without consulting the young lady. When the gentleman's answer came, it not only pleased the fond parent, but met the approval of Miss Davis, and immediately a lively correspondence with an exchange of photographs sprung up. This continued for a year, and by that time the young man decided that Miss Davis was the girl he wanted, and asked her to come to North Dakota and to be his wife. He wrote the grandmother at the same time, assuring her of the sincerity and desires to give her grandchild a good home. The date was set, and the young lady, accompanied by Mrs. Davis, reached Lakota last evening. It was agreed beforehand that each should wear a bouquet of flowers so that there would be no difficulty in recognizing one another. Mr. Bartley was at the depot at Lakota with a large number of friends. It was a case of complete satisfaction, and they lost no time in coming to the county seat to secure the license and have the ceremony performed. It occurred at the Sevilla Hotel last evening, and the bride looked very attractive in a suit of dark blue serge with a veil of bridal net, caught with a wreath, and carrying a large bridal bouquet. Mr. and Mrs. Maloof, who are residents of the Sevilla, consented to be the attendants, and it was a very impressive scene. Had it not been the busy season of the year, I assume that means for farming, the groom would have had a more elaborate wedding with a reception at his large country home. But under the circumstances, it was a very quiet affair. And that's from the Devil's Lake Daily Journal, 1912. Not everyone who favorably answered mail-order bride advertisements enjoyed happily ever-after endings. In the case of a bachelor from Buford, North Dakota, the wedding was called off shortly after the engaged couple met. Strange indeed was the experience of two girls, aged 19 and 20 years, who reached the city of Buford on Saturday without money and absolutely helpless. This is from the Wahpeton Times of North Dakota, March 9, 1911. As the story goes, the two girls left their homes, for they are not sisters, several weeks ago to come to Buford, North Dakota. One of the girls has been corresponding with a farmer living near Buford, and their correspondence had progressed to the point where he had popped the question. The girl immediately started for Buford from faraway New York, but her friend insisted on accompanying her, probably with the hope that she, too, would become entangled matrimonially. But when they arrived at Buford, and the elder of the two had gazed upon the face of the man with whom she had been corresponding, the spell was immediately broken. He didn't suit. In fact, he wouldn't do at all. The other girl fully acquiesced in the decision, and so they started back again. As girls will do, they carried all their money in one pocketbook, and in some way this was lost, with the result that they reached Grand Forks financially embarrassed, to say the least. They took the only course they could take under the circumstances and told their story to Police Chief Lowe. Through his aid, and that of other interested citizens, enough money was raised to send them at least a long way on their return trip to Rochester. They are sadder and wiser girls than when they left home, and it is hardly likely that they will ever again, no matter what matrimonial stringency may come, try the correspondence route to matrimony. And again, that's from the Wahpeton Times, North Dakota, March 9, 1911. In spite of the occasional mismatch or short-lived union, historians at the National Archive Department in Washington believe that mail-order brides produced a high percentage of permanent marriages. The reason cited is that the advertisements were candid and direct in their explanations of exactly what was wanted and expected from a prospective spouse, and if requested, the parties involved sent accurate photos of themselves along with a page of background information. Often, when the pair met, the groom-to-be signed an agreement, witnessed by three upstanding members of the territory, not to abuse or mistreat the bride-to-be. The prospective bride then signed a paper, also witnessed, not to nag or to try to change the intended. Desperate bachelors and pining maidens were willing to consent to whatever terms were necessary in order to secure a spouse. The scarcity of females in the West and the rapidly changing times forced traditional thinking women and men to succumb to new ways of finding a mate. Mail-order couples wed in hopes that their mutually beneficial marriage would develop into love. History records that many times the result was, indeed, a happily ever after life for both. And that concludes our reading of Hearts West, True Stories of Mail-Order Brides on the Frontier, by Chris Enns. We have a few minutes left, and I was curious about other perspectives on mail-order brides, and I found this in the Saturday Evening Post of June 5, 2023. It's entitled, How Mail-Order Brides Shaped America. Matrimonial ads in the late 1800s helped our young country grow. And this was by Linda Rodriguez McRobbie. On June 4, 1871, Sarah Baines hopped down from a wagon at Fort Bridger, a remote military and trading outpost at the crossroads of several pioneer trails in what would one day become Wyoming. Baines, a 24-year-old seamstress from Louisiana, had just spent several months traveling 1,500 miles through roadless territory alone. But she wouldn't be alone for long. She'd come to Fort Bridger to get married. The groom was Jay Hemsley, a 48-year-old farmer who'd left Ohio some years before to seek his fortune out west. The two had met after Hemsley responded to an ad placed in the matrimonial pages of the October 12, 1869 edition of Frank Leslie's Illustrated Weekly. They corresponded via letter for more than a year before Hemsley proposed. The day after Baines arrived at Fort Bridger, they were married by the fort's minister in a small ceremony on the banks of Groshen Creek. The next day, they left to open a general store in Placerville, California, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. the Hemsleys were married for 51 years. It seems like a tremendous risk, traveling thousands of miles into lonely territory to marry a person you met through an advertisement in a newspaper. But it was a gamble that many men and women in the 19th century were willing to take. It's not quite the same gamble today, but that approach to finding companionship, a partner in a life that can otherwise be lonely, is still important in 21st century rural life. The rise of personal and matrimonial ads, appeals for companionship in newspapers and magazines, as well as in specialist publications devoted entirely to matchmaking in 19th century America, was a then-modern solution to an age-old problem. The development of personal ads tracks the populating of America, says Francesca Bowman, who wrote about Baines and Hemsley in her 2020 History of the American Personal Ad, Matrimony, Inc. Put another way, without personals, Manifest Destiny couldn't have, well, manifested. America at the time was expanding at a tremendous rate, unprecedented for virtually any modern nation. The signing of the 1803 Louisiana Purchase, for example, nearly doubled the size of the country with the flourish of a pen. And over the next 50 years, millions of square miles were added through wars, purchases, and the killing or forcible removal of the Native Americans who already lived there. The first white people who moved into these territories were often single men. According to the 1840 census, men in Wisconsin, for example, outnumbered women 2-to-1. The farther west, the more obvious the lack of women. One California newspaper claimed in 1859 that male settlers in the recently minted state outnumbered women 200-to-1. Exploiting those huge tracts of land, which were, again, not unused or unoccupied, meant more than just flinging people out into the vastness and hoping they'd take root. The U.S. government knew that. One homesteading act offered 320 acres of land to a single man, but 640 acres to married couples. People also needed partners if they expected to be able to work that land or keep a house, and they needed community and infrastructure for support and protection. That meant marriages. "We have goods enough," said a California man, according to a report that appeared in the Indiana State Sentinel in 1849. "Now, give us some wives." The question was, of course, how? Whenever you're geographically isolated, you're always going to be needing a bit of help and support finding a wife or a husband, because you're not going to meet them down at the store or at church through a friend. "That ain't going to work," says Bowman. Newspapers became an essential way that farmers, anyone who is geographically isolated, were going to find a spouse, both for men and women. The invention of the steam printing press in the early 1800s meant that newspapers were becoming easier to produce, and therefore cheaper and more widespread. The first personal ad in America, according to Bowman, was placed in the Boston Evening Post in 1759, and it read, "Any young lady, between the age of 18 and 23, of middling stature, brown hair, of good morals, etc., etc., etc." And by the end of this century, newspapers in every state carried them. Urbanization and population growth, driven by mobility and by immigration, meant that the usual methods of forging relationships and connections, established friends, families, religious leaders, social circles, simply weren't always available. But newspapers and access to the wider society they represented were available. "With any new media, the first use is to build relationships," says Bowman. This was the same story, with the added pressure of the dramatic gender imbalance that was unfolding in other parts of the country. By the middle of the 19th century, personal ads were semi-regular features of most newspapers, and some canny entrepreneurs began selling broadsheets, such as Matrimonial News, that only carried marriage ads. These markets expanded with the country as the railroads and telegraph wires that increasingly crisscrossed the nation enabled the easier spread of both people and of information. At the same time, it wasn't just bachelors who needed partners. An observer in a Philadelphia paper in 1837 reported a superabundance of women in urban areas back east, a big problem when roles for women in society were largely restricted to marriage and domestic work. The economic opportunities for women at the time were very, very limited and pretty miserable, says Bowman. So while it might seem like a pretty big leap that your best option was to travel thousands of miles to marry a man you'd never met, for many women, it did seem like the best option. Women in the East also actively placed marriage ads seeking matches with men out West. In July 1880, for example, a Mrs. Sarah Wilcox of Fall River, Massachusetts, placed her ad in the Weekly Arizona Miner of Prescott, Arizona. Wanted: a few gentlemen correspondents with a view to matrimony by a middle-aged widow lady. There was real risk of death, violence, and isolation attached to the frontier. Yet many women still went, which underscores how little there was for them in the civilized parts of the country, says Bowman. It would have been pretty grim, but exciting, better than sitting in a tenement building, sewing. Socially, personal and matrimonial ads were regarded by some with a mixture of amusement, skepticism, and fear. People always worried about the breakdown of society, says Bowman, particularly the fact that people of all classes were represented on the page, that some ads were too nakedly transactional, and that, by the 1870s, some ads were looking for marriage, and others explicitly for fun. This ambivalence was evident in how papers wrote about marriage ads. According to one possibly apocryphal but definitely amusing story that circulated in newspapers in 1854, one chap out west tried advertising for a wife. It worked to a charm as usual. In the response to his ad, he allegedly received 794 letters, 24 shirt buttons, 17 locks of hair, 13 daguerreotypes, 2 gold rings, 1 copy of L.K. Marvel's 1850 bestseller, Reveries of a Bachelor, and 1 thimble. He ought to be convinced, the Hartford Courant remarked. In 1910, the Wichita Eagle reported with sardonic glee that a Miss Effie Newland, one of the wealthy young women of Hoxie, Kansas, married a Mr. Lopez, a sailor of Key West, Florida, after she jokingly responded to his ad for a wife. But Lopez was a splendid writer, and the girl soon became infatuated with his love-making prose, the paper claimed. Lopez traveled to Hoxie, and the couple were married while the parents protested. Other stories fueled the panic that marriages made outside the bounds of society were dangerous. The Los Angeles Herald reported on October 31, 1897, that a 32-year-old man shot and killed his heavily insured 19-year-old wife, whom he'd met through an advertisement in a matrimonial paper. Of course, stories with happy endings, marriages that didn't end in murder, abandonment, abuse, fraud, or divorce, were also written about in newspapers and helped popularize the practice. One headline from 1907 declared, "Girl writes in secret and wins a rich planter," the story of an Indiana woman who met her husband through an ad in a matrimonial paper. The pair spent 3 years writing to each other in secret and married the day they met in person. This may be why personal ads endured. There was evidence that they worked, even for people in remote areas, just as there's evidence that they, or to be more precise, dating sites and apps, still work. Today, most of us are not now hacking out a farm on the dusty plains, the nearest neighbor a day's wagon ride away, or panning for gold in mining camps reachable only by donkey. But people do live in geographically or socially isolated areas, just like the men and women who created communities on the frontier. And finally, here's a word of caution from the Saturday Evening Post archive on The Art of the Con. Seeking a spouse through personal ads in newspapers was a risky venture. Con artists were eager to prey on people's trust, as illustrated in an 1856 article from the Saturday Evening Post. A very curious affair in the way of matrimonial swindling has just come to light in New York. For some time, it seems, a man calling himself Dr. S. Thrasher Lyons has been sojourning there and moving in respectable circles. He represented himself as a man of wealth, and as he lived and appeared well, the circumstances seemed to confirm his representations, though facts recently developed show him to have been a deep-dyed scoundrel, capable of perpetrating any crime. He is about 45 years of age, highly educated, and extremely engaging in his manner. So far as it can be ascertained, he's confined his schemes of rascality to swindling women out of money, with whom he would get into communication by advertising for wives under assumed names in the morning papers. So systematic and extensive, indeed, have been his schemes that scarcely a week has passed that he has not advertised. He also patronized the matrimonial department of the papers, made the acquaintance of many foolish women, every one of whom, it is hardly necessary to say, he most shamefully deceived. Once in communication with a lady, he would obtain a knowledge of her peculiar circumstances, and if she had means, he would continue the acquaintance, ingratiate himself in her favor, make a formal engagement, offer his services in making investments for her, accept her money, pocket it, and discontinue his visits. It is said that he married several wives, and having possessed himself of their means, has left them. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.